Disasters happen frequently around the world, putting pressure on emergency responders and healthcare providers, but disasters do not tend to affect the entire world at once, so the pressure on responders and providers tends to be confined to one area. Not so in a pandemic like the COVID-19 outbreak. With no cure and no vaccine for this new virus and air travel making it possible to move people and microbes around the world quickly, all countries are dealing with or braced for the onslaught of many, many sick people at once. And that kind of pressure on healthcare challenges people and supplies, but also ethics. We'll spend much of this hour exploring ethics in a pandemic. Our guest, Devorah Shapiro, is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Southern Oregon University and the co-coordinator of the Healthcare Administration Program at SOU. Devorah, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange. You there, Devorah?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. There you go. Okay, good. And then we're trying to get hold of the Reverend Pandora Canton, who's a chaplain at Providence Hospice in Medford. But in the meantime, we'll start with Devorah. Thank you for joining us again today on The Exchange. And let's start with an overview of what you do. The program sounds really interesting, the Healthcare Administration Program at SOU.
Yes. Actually, we have a new program, the Healthcare Administration Program. It's been going for about 3 years now. And there is a definite need in Southern Oregon and around the state for additional individuals to be working in healthcare administration. As we've seen, the change from clinic-based running of medical practice has really shifted over to larger organizations running medicine. And so healthcare administrators are even more important now than they have been in the past.
So, but these are not people who are, they're going to have a general knowledge of healthcare, but they're not going to have, for example, nursing skills necessarily, right?
No, though we do have some students who are clinical based. And so generally in healthcare, we have a distinction between those who are clinicians and those who work in other kinds of administrative roles. And what we are doing over at Southern Oregon University is we're training individuals who don't necessarily have a clinical background, though some of them may. In fact, those individuals who have a clinical background may be particularly interested in a healthcare administration program because it will add to their ability to run the systems that are immediately in their purview. So, for example, nurses and physicians frequently will, at a certain point, decide to get into some healthcare administration as well.
All right. So they'll have the medical skills, the clinical skills, but also want to know something about how to run the place overall.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And just as an aside for you, Devorah, how are you finding the distance learning just a couple of days into this quarter?
Well, it's not my preferred medium, but it is what we're doing right now. And certainly it is much better than not having classes at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that most of the professors on campus are finding it reasonable to scoot over into Zoom classes where we can see our students, but we don't necessarily have the same kind of ability to walk around, gesticulate, these sorts of things. But we can still see and correspond with our students immediately.
That must feel like being in a box for somebody who likes to walk around and gesticulate, as you say.
It is, yes. I'm actually much more comfortable sitting in front of a room of people than I am in front of a computer talking to them. So
that makes sense. So let's come back to medical ethics then, and then give me some opening thoughts, if you would, on the challenges faced by people in the healthcare profession by this pandemic.
Oh, the challenges are widespread. So as I was saying previously, there is a distinction, of course, between those clinicians who have a direct duty to assist their patients and have direct relationships with their patients. So, for example, physicians, nurses, others who are directly in patient care. And then there are those who are at the management level and public health level. And the difference in what it looks like when one is understanding ethical concerns, depending on whether you're doing direct clinical medical work or whether you're doing public health work, is significant. The individual clinicians will be concerned about taking care of their individual patients. When there's a lack of resources, they have to think about what kinds of immediate resources can they use to help those individual patients. Whereas those who are at the public health level, at the state level, at the organization level, will be concerned primarily with their duty to provide resources and to allocate those resources in reasonable and responsible ways.
All right, so they have to have the people in management and public health have to have the more big picture kind of thing about how to allocate resources generally, not having knowledge of individual patients as the clinicians do.
That's right. And those requirements and those obligations, the ethical obligations of those who are organizing and implementing different kinds of procedures, those individuals have the obligation actually to plan for these things ahead of time And so what we're seeing is that there are some areas where such things really have been planned for. There are a lot of plans in place and protocols already getting ready. But in other areas, potentially, we've had some issues with those kinds of obligations being put at the forefront.
Well, you've had a chance to look at this now from your perspective as somebody who runs a healthcare administration learning program to look at the kinds of things that were and were not done in planning for the pandemic. Do you have an overall sense of what how well things have been done and not?
Well, there are a lot of different levels of healthcare delivery. So we live in a country, and the country at large will have obligations to plan for such pandemics or epidemics. And then we have the individual state level, we have the county level, and then we have organizations who are private organizations that have obligations because they have taken on healthcare and healthcare delivery. And then you have the immediate individuals who are providing that care. And so, we have different states, and the different states have dealt with things differently. Washington State actually is a really nice example of a state that has already organized these kinds of procedures. They really are leading the region in a lot of ways with the procedures and the protocols that they had in place. And that's fantastic. And we've seen how well they've done in responding to the pandemic. Other areas have had a harder time implementing that, and that is also because of larger issues of wealth and economic stability.
You mean because the states themselves are not wealthy or economically stable?
That's correct, because mm-hmm. some states have a lower level of resources. Also, individual states may have chosen to allocate their resources differently, and so they may not have the kinds of support that they need. Additionally, we have a serious divide between rural health systems, of which Southern Oregon is an area of rural health, generally speaking, versus urban health systems. We have a lot higher concentration of medical resources in those urban areas and much less access to healthcare in the rural areas, which is one of the reasons why the healthcare administration program at SOU is concerned about providing healthcare rural areas.
Which is an ongoing issue. I mean, we talked not long ago about the numbers of rural hospitals that have closed over the last few years and how many more are hanging by a thread, it seems, financially to be able to continue. And then as you look at, then of course I was reading this morning too about the fact that the rural areas had been pretty much spared COVID-19 outbreaks until now, but it looks like it certainly is beginning to happen. I just wonder, I mean, how concerned you might be as you look at this from a public health perspective about trying to make sure that there's enough medical expertise and equipment to handle the outbreak when it does come to the rural areas.
Well, I'm not someone who specifically works in the management of healthcare, but from the perspective of someone who is concerned about obligations to the public, our withdrawal of resources from rural areas and our allowance of individualized corporations to sort of move into the delivery of healthcare is potentially a problem, specifically in states and in counties that have a large amount of rural health needed. And so it is understandable that those rural health areas don't have the opportunities for business in the same way that the urban areas do, but that doesn't mean that we don't need to provide healthcare resources. Healthcare resources are the sorts of things that individual citizens can expect from their government. And so as a larger government, we have that obligation, ethically speaking, to provide access to medical care in rural areas as well. And it is also the case that in a pandemic such as the one that's going on right now, we at least have a little bit of lead time in those rural areas because there are fewer people there. There is a smaller concentration of risk to individuals, and the social distancing that we've seen around the globe is easier to maintain in those areas. They're more spread out. But we do have to think carefully about providing what we are responsible for those individuals in rural areas.
We're talking about medical ethics in this pandemic with Devorah Shapiro, who's an associate professor of philosophy at Southern Oregon University and the co-coordinator of the healthcare administration program at SOU. We're still trying to raise the Reverend Pandora Canton, who's a chaplain at the Providence Hospice in Medford. You're welcome to join the conversation with us, though, and talk about the things that you have seen in medical ethics and decisions that have been made along the way. Let's get this to a more open discussion. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about the protocols and procedures that Washington State implemented that you thought had been done fairly well. Give us an idea of what you're talking about there.
So Washington State has planned, generally speaking, for pandemics. There was a larger concern about a pandemic influenza, but because of that, they have an entire sort of plan in place already. And that has been around for a little while, and it really has informed the scarce resource management and crisis standards of care that they have in place has really informed the larger region. And so that's been available to them. In what you saw in Seattle, for example, was an organized effort to contain and treat individuals when the outbreak began. And they are set up to deal with the overload of patients already. What we look for, generally speaking, with those protocols is for those protocols to already be in place so that individual clinicians don't have to make those decisions themselves. What can happen a lot is you can have a lot of moral distress involved in treating patients when you have a lack of resources. Clinicians themselves can be overwhelmed by the responsibility of making those decisions in the immediate future. And so we have these protocols in place to assist clinicians so that they don't have to make unbelievable kinds of choices between treating patients. And that's why the larger scope of a medical ethics plan will involve clinicians deciding ahead of time how to allocate resources. And there will be clinicians on site who are in a separate spot from the individuals who are directly treating the patients, so that those triage decisions can be made away from the individual patients.
So a plan in place, in essence, then, a playbook, for lack of a better term, to know what you're going to do when things get crunchy.
That's right. And so you'll have resource recommendations already, put into place, general preparedness set up, capacity understandings, and these sorts of things in place so that the doctors who are supervisory will already have in place a way of making decisions, so the individual doctors who are treating patients immediately can go to those supervisory physicians and ask where the resources need to be allocated in the moment.
I was going to ask you what the buffer level is, because I couldn't imagine the clinicians talking directly, most of them anyway, to administrators, but then there are supervisory physicians then who do have the direct interface with the administrators.
Well, so you have to be careful here, because healthcare administrators are, generally speaking, not clinicians. Mm-hmm. And so medical choices need to be made by physicians themselves.
Sure.
So those clinicians are the ones who are going to make treatment decisions. When you have a supervisory clinician, that person will be an MD, a physician, and that person will understand the scope of their resource allocations and will understand what's possible. And based on what's possible, those clinicians will make actual medical decisions. We don't want administrators making medical decisions.
No, but they have to make resource decisions, don't they? About, like, well, we can't afford to do this, or we can't do that because of this. I mean, I guess I'm doing this in the negative, but they could also say, yes, we can take care of this, but it will take time. But there are going to be moments when administrators are faced with resource issues as well, aren't they?
Oh, of course. And which is exactly why the fundamental duty of those administrators and the managers of public health is to actually plan in advance and to have resources lined up to understand where the scarcities are going to arise, and then to make sure that they have properly managed the resources that will be available. Of course, if you end up in a situation where that planning hasn't happened, then you start having to make those individual decisions. Those clinicians will have to make individual decisions that are extreme. And so that's why that duty to manage for healthcare administrators is so strong. Once we get to the level of the supervisory clinician, if if those proper resources are not already in place, we have significant problems. And but there is always that concern about there being a literal lack of resources. And when that happens, that's when you get to rating systems of patients where you have to consider different, for example, whether their organs are shutting down. When you have different sort of clinical decisions based on triage protocols and deciding which patients will be best served by receiving treatment. And that's where the clinician makes those resource judgments.
All right, so rating systems, it sounds like, you're talking about somebody who despite best efforts, might be likely to die anyway. That, are we talking to that level of understanding?
Yeah, so I'm not a clinician. Mm-hmm. I'm a medical ethicist.
Understood.
but I work with clinicians. And there is, for example, the rating system that a lot of clinicians will use in protocols. SOFA, it has to do with sort of looking at organ systems, at likelihood of survival, and these sorts of things. And that is when you reach that critical point, which we have not reached in Oregon, thankfully. Oregon is doing very well. But if you are in a situation where you reach the point, as they did in Italy, where you have to make decisions on where to allocate ventilators, then physicians will make decisions based on rating of patients and their likelihood of survival. But it is exactly because those clinicians cannot be expected to make decisions like that immediately in front of them that we have those supervisory clinicians who have generalized protocols to assist the individual clinicians in the allocation of those immediate resources.
Medical ethics in the pandemic, the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. Devorah Shapiro is an associate professor of philosophy at Southern Oregon University and the co-coordinator of the healthcare administration program at SOU. We also add now the Reverend Pandora Canton, who is a chaplain at Providence Hospice in Medford. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm late.
That's okay. Third time's the charm. We finally found the right phone number for you. So, and Devorah, thank you for carrying the load this far. So, Pandora, let's come to you. Give us an overview of what it is that you do.
So, I have been a chaplain for over 12 years. I've studied at UCSF. I've had a lot of concentration on ethics in my clinical pastoral education, as well as being with Devorah and running the ethics committee in Ashland Hospital. I am, Providence is a little different. We have an ethics committee up in Portland that we call into, but ethics, especially at this time, continues to be a really great area for me to start learn and study from. And so as a hospice chaplain, some of the ethics that we're dealing with, we kind of deal with every day. You know, what is our choices? What is our autonomy? What is the autonomy for the good of the people? Basically, I, as a hospice chaplain, I deal with people that are dying all the time.
And you're called in. Well, let's come back to the hospice situation generally. What will dictate when somebody is going to hospice? Hospice is going to be called.
So usually the doctor says that they have one of the qualifiers is that you have to have 6 months or less to live, so that you are in a terminal illness that there's nothing that can be done anymore, or people decide, I'm done. I want to go on hospice. So that's the number one qualification. And then the other, and you have to have some underlying comorbidity, whether it's COPD with something else, whether it's cancer. So we identify your underlying comorbidities to then say, hey, you're going to go on to hospice. You do need to be identified by your doctor as hospice appropriate. And then our hospices, whether it's Sante, because I worked for Sante too, hospice, is that we will come and evaluate whether you are ready for hospice or not. And hospice doesn't mean you're going to die. We've had people that have been discharged from hospice because they have gotten better because of our good care, of our nurses coming out twice a week, once to twice a week, to really care for those. And some people plateau and get better and get discharged and have a few more years' life and then perhaps a few years later come back to us.
But does hospice generally mean that you're past the point of intensive care? You're just not going to put that much, I don't want to say effort, but the fact is that the choice has been made that going after this heavily medically isn't going to have any particular payoff.
Well, yes. Usually any kind of, oftentimes our patients, the doctors will tell them that any other care is futile, that there's nothing more that we can do, that we have. And still some people say, well, I want a second opinion. I want to try to do more. But usually if a doctor says it's futile, it's probably appropriate that you go on hospice. You know, it's up to each and every doctor, and that's one of the things that we as hospice try to really work with doctors with is when are we, especially in ethics, when are we not doing harm anymore? Because oftentimes radical medical treatments can continue to have someone suffer. And that's up to the person. That's our autonomy, which is one of the greatest pillars of ethics. But when is it that, you know, either a person decides or that enough is enough? I've had enough.
Did you say autonomy is one of the greatest pillars of ethics?
I believe so.
In what sense?
Because in what sense is that we get to, especially right now in our medical industry, really decide what our plan of care is and what we want our treatment to look like, if possible. How far do we want to go on? So within the hospital and the working condition, if you say, hey, you write your advance directive out and you say, oh, I don't really want CPR at this time. But then you get into a situation and you decide, and you can decide that you want CPR and that you want to be resuscitated. That autonomy will trump whatever, even what you've written.
All right, we'll have more of this discussion coming up on the other side of a break. We're talking to the Reverend Pandora Canton, who's chaplain at Providence Hospice in Medford, also a Sante. And we're talking to Devorah Shapiro as well, associate professor of philosophy at Southern Oregon University. We'll come back to the discussion of ethics. You're welcome to join by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Pandora, I want to get your take, because we haven't gotten here yet, about your thoughts on the challenges faced by people in the healthcare profession from the virus pandemic.
Well, especially for me as a clinical chaplain, it's really sad to see that when I go out and visit patients, and I am still visiting patients because people are dying, is that I have one mask a day, and it's not even an N95, it's a surgical mask. And then I turn my mask in, and they clean them and send them back to me. And I don't have a problem with the cleaning, but it's sad that we're at this state that we don't have the protective equipment that we need. So that's one of my biggest things, and reading it and seeing all the people that I work with also in both hospitals, the lack of equipment that we have is it's very scary. I mean, to go in and to think, okay, I'm doing my job, but I might get COVID is very interesting. I think the one other thing that I think is really important here is that, there's this in fact, my daughter said it to me yesterday, they're picking who's going to live and who's going to die. And it's like, no, that's not quite like what it is. And the thing is that, we have to, like I talked about autonomy being really important in ethics. Right now, our autonomy should be for the good of all, not just one person. And so we're kind of having a switch in autonomy. The Hastings Center, which is one group in on the chaplaincy out of University of Chicago, we're talking a lot about this, of how do we look at the good of all rather than the good of one. And that's pretty scary for the United States, because it's, again, our first thing is an autonomy in medical care. It's what do I want for myself? And perhaps at this time we cannot look at what we need just for ourselves, but for the good of the community. The other thing that I think is important is that who is making these decisions are our friends, are our neighbors. There are doctors and nurses that we live and work with. And I'm sure everybody knows somebody. And they don't take these decisions lightly either. So I think this whole fear of how this is working, especially in Oregon, where we've, you know, in Jackson County, where we've had no deaths, is something that we don't really have to think about right here, right now. I mean, we can think about it, but if you think about it, I would suggest as you think about, do I want to be intubated? Have I asked myself the questions of what if I go into the hospital, what will this look like for me and what do I want? Because usually they want to intubate you within an hour or so, so you don't have a long time to think about this.
Mm-hmm. So best to have this decision outlined in advance, you're saying.
Yes, yes. I think you have to think about, okay, do I look at what intubation looks like if you have never seen it? How long do you want to be intubated? They're putting a tube down your throat, and you're going to be sedated as you do that. So you're not going to talk to your loved ones. You're not going to talk to your family during this illness because you have to be sedated to be intubated. Otherwise, you're going to pull out that tube, which is not pretty. So do you want that? What's the quality of life that you might have after this? We're seeing some things that people have, it's going to damage their lungs for a long time. Is that a course you want? So I think even before any of this discussions of who is going to intubate who, it's like we have to ask ourselves, what do we want? What does intubation look like? How long do I want to be intubated? If I'm intubated for 2 weeks, then I want a feeding tube? It's not a simple question and answer because it has many complications. And so I think that we need to be prepared if it were to happen. What is it we want? And for me in particular, I don't want to be intubated. I don't want that stuff in my throat. I've seen it too many times. So if I go in, I'll probably say, hey, if I'm that bad, give me comfort care meds and let me die, and let the illness take its course because I work with death. So I'm not too afraid of it.
Understood. So, Devorah Shapiro, I know you don't work with a clinical program in healthcare administration, but I do have to believe you've at least begun to talk about this in students. I mean, you had part of last quarter to talk about it, and it's probably front and center for any discussions of the healthcare industry this quarter.
Yeah. So, I mean, we actually do talk quite a bit about this. And last quarter, as it turned out, I was teaching a course called Healthcare Injustice. And so what Pandora is talking about with autonomy is self-direction, making choices, having the freedom to make a choice for yourself. And it also requires an understanding of respect for others and for yourself. And it's one of what we think of generally as four principles of medical ethics. So we've got autonomy, and then we have non-maleficence, which is what we always think of as first do no harm, and then beneficence, which is what we think of as doing the good generally. And justice, which is a much more complex topic. But when we think about all these different ethical principles in play in specific decisions on how to access medical resources or think about others in the context of making choices in a pandemic, each of these four principles plays a very large part. And so when we think about not doing harm from the individual perspective of a clinician, what you don't want to do, as Pandora was suggesting, is create a worse problem for the individual, for their family, and for your larger community. If intubating individuals is going to create a greater burden for that person, for the family, and for the larger community, then it's not something that we would want to suggest. Beneficence is the obligation to do good. And right now, we clearly understand that healthcare professionals, those in healthcare organizations, et cetera, have an obligation to be doing their best to do the best for their community. But it is sometimes difficult to understand how that can be done. When we think about justice, for example, we frequently forget that not all of our community members have the same access to medical treatments, and not all of our community members will have had the same background of access to medical treatments. And so we have a lot of community members who start off at a lower level of general well-being and health care. And so what that means then is that their access to care is already limited by the fact that they are coming into such a situation with many different kinds of disparities in health already.
This must be providing then some fairly substantive examples to be able to discuss with students about the kinds of things that the healthcare profession faces at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does, yeah. Definitely. What we frequently talk quite a bit about is our general structure of healthcare and how we can avoid situations that we're in right now by providing larger access to individual community members.
Pandora, I hear you agreeing.
Oh, yes, I think she put it really well. The other thing that I think that we need to look at is when we talk about medical ethics so much, we look at the patient. I think we need to look at and apply those medical ethics to our workers, too. Where is the justice for them? Where is the time that it's like there is too much, again, not in Jackson, just talking bigger worldwide, is when is the resources a pillar that's collapsing for our health workers?
Allocating supplies for the medical professionals seems like this would be a big part of not just supplies, but also, as you mentioned, time. And I mean, so you've mentioned a couple of times now, Pandora, and we certainly can confirm with, I think, 6 cases ever hospitalized in Jackson County, not a big crush on hospitals here, but you mentioned running low on surgical masks and things. So just simply because more equipment is being used as people come into the hospital now, what accounts for the shortage if there hasn't been a real crush of business?
Well, I think because we're gearing up for it and we're being, and especially in Oregon, we're being really resourceful of how do we use it if it gets bigger. But I think that the resources nationwide are just not there for us. I feel safe with Providence at this time because I wear my mask and I don't see so many people. I'm not so sure in the hospitals. I think our hospitals are again okay. I just don't think that we're ready for this. I think Providence started getting ready for this quite a while ago. I think Providence did a really great job of getting ready for this because back in, I think March 6th, we started really, really talking about it and how we were going to change things and who we were going to see. It's just, I'm not sure where the disconnect is because I'm not in the hospitals right now, mm-hmm. but I just know that we're being really careful with our supplies. And again, that's that causes pause. Are our caretakers being taken care of well?
We are talking medical ethics here on the Jefferson Exchange. Pandora Canton, the Reverend Pandora Canton, is a chaplain at Providence Hospice in Medford. Devorah Shapiro is an associate professor of philosophy at Southern Oregon University and the co-coordinator of the Healthcare Administration Program. You can join in at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's an email here from Rebecca in Lane County. She writes, "This is a timely, great discussion. A great aunt of mine decided to stop eating and drinking at 99. Having an option of an easy timed death surrounded by family and friends would have been so much better," she writes. Thank you for that, Rebecca. This is something that people talk about often, but it seems like the conversation doesn't happen until very close to the end.
Yeah, we are not prepared in the United States to talk about death. We should be sitting at our dining room tables with people that are over 18, asking them what is their quality of life that they want? What do they see for themselves? Because usually when ethics cases come up, it's usually because people are trying to continue medical care where perhaps they have said in the past that they don't want to. You know, so this is something we should, and we have deaf cafes in Ashland that are very good of helping us really disseminate what we want. And I think that we talked about no CPR and perhaps no medical things of do not resuscitate. But I don't think in this time of COVID we've asked ourselves, do we want to be put on a ventilator? And if so, for how long? So, yes, these are conversations that we should be having, and everyone should have their advance directive filled out.
Devorah Shapiro, as you teach students in medical ethics and things like healthcare and justice at Southern Oregon University, I wonder how broadly you draw the picture, particularly now where you can talk about ethics outside the clinic, you know, ethics outside even the hospital administration or the healthcare system administration to government planning and decisions like, you know, when to close borders and if all that is being incorporated into your curriculum now.
Absolutely. So when I teach medical ethics, I teach healthcare injustice because those individual internal clinical decision-making systems don't exist in a vacuum. We have a larger community. We have a country. And so when we are thinking about our ethical obligations, we can't just be thinking about individuals talking to each other. We have to think about those larger systems. What you've seen so far across the country are varied responses to the concerns that we have as a larger country. In some areas, individuals suppose that it's not their obligation to care about people across the country. Individual governments at the state level will decide it's not our problem, we don't have it here. And those are the sorts of things that are inconsistent with a larger understanding of our interconnectedness and our obligations to each other. They're both pragmatically and ethically concerning. And so we talk a lot about how the larger community must understand itself not as individuals working, but as persons in relationships with others. And those larger relationships are constructed around and organized around our government in this country. And if our government, our large government or individually smaller governments at the state and community levels are not working together and seeing themselves as a larger system, we will not only have failed ethically, but we will also pragmatically have more people being sick and dying.
This is a discussion that ultimately goes well beyond the healthcare realm when you frame it this way, because we're talking about, you know, you have your set of rights, but when your rights and your exercising of them infringes on other people's, then we start getting into a problem area.
Well, that's right. And so these are not, all of these rights are part of the same system. And so we think about, for example, the harm principle. If you think about how your rights expand so that you can do what you will, and everybody else's rights expand in just the same way, there's a balance point where doing what you want to do is going to interfere with someone else's right to do what they want. So we have to balance everybody's rights so that we work together.
Okay, we're just about ready to wrap up. Any final thoughts from you on this, Pandora Canton?
I think that Devorah really hit it. Is that right now, especially, we have to think of rights of a community, not our own singular rights, but how do we act within a community? What is the greatest good? And not have this fear thing of that if you go into the hospital that they're going to make decisions for you. You're going to be part of the decision. But the thing is the decision makers are your community. They are your friends. They are your family. And that this whole thing of fear needs to be taken out of this to be really, that we are the Rogue Valley and that we all work together for the common good. And that common good is not just necessarily about my rights, but other rights of a community.
You've both given us a lot to think about. I very much appreciate you joining us for a discussion of medical ethics in a pandemic. The Reverend Pandora Canton is chaplain at Providence Hospice in Medford, a member of the Ethics Committee at Ashland Asante Ashland Community Hospital, as is Devorah Shapiro, who's an associate professor of philosophy at Southern Oregon University and the co-coordinator of the Healthcare Administration Program at SOU. Thank you both so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Okay, take care.